Welcome back to The Film Experience. This is Nathaniel R., and I'm here with Murtada.
Hello, Nathaniel, in this cold Sunday morning. How's everyone doing?
I overslept for the first time in ages.
I know. I was like, what is happening? Where is Nathaniel?
But I guess maybe the movies weren't exciting enough to wake me up. No, I'm kidding. Let's start with The Front Runner.
Oh, my God.
Which is the story of American Senator Gary Hart's presidential campaign.
Yes.
1988.
Yes, the 3 weeks where he went from being the front-runner Democratic nominee to completely having his campaign implode.
Yes. This is a case of having expectations lowered being a good thing. Because I actually liked it. Everybody kept saying how bad it was.
Yes, I did not. Tell me what you liked about it.
Well, first of all, I have to share a story.
Sure.
So I show up at the movie theater, and because I went there directly from an interview with Rachel Weisz, coming soon to The Film Experience.
All right. We love Rachel. Yay.
I was not online, so I had not ordered through AMC Stubs or whatever. So I go to the theater, and I'm doing the boop, boop, boop to buy the tickets. And the machine jams, so no tickets come out. And this guy runs up as it says, your tickets are being printed. And he's like, don't order tickets. And I was like, well, it's a little late because it already, you know, it already happened. So then another worker comes up and they're like, they open the machine and there's this huge spool of like crumpled tickets.
What theater is this?
This is AMC Lincoln Square. So
let's call them out.
So they actually start unspooling the thread of these, like, crunched up tickets. Like, you can barely see what's on them. And they look at me and they're like, Bohemian Rhapsody?
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, no. And then the girl goes, Boy Erased? And I'm like, no. What are you two implying? So anyway, that was funny.
That was funny. Not as funny as The Front Runner, which is so serious.
It is. But I actually, you know, I kept hearing that it was Altman-esque, and I kept complaining, you shouldn't compare yourself to Altman because he's a master, and what he does is very hard to do. The sort of roaming camera, huge teeming cast, overlapping dialogue. And there are times when The Front Runner feels like imitative and that it isn't sure how to pull that off. But I think the story of Gary Hart's fairly compelling, and I thought all the actors were good. You know, even though it's not an actor showcase per se, it felt very sort of, everyone seemed on the same page. Everybody knew the same movie they were making. I liked it. I mean, I didn't love it, but I thought it was good.
I actually thought it was sluggish and flat. And, like, it did want to do the zip-zap-zap sort of, like, conversation, dialogue between different characters in different situations, doing different points of view. But to me, it just felt flat. Like, they thought they were doing something interesting, but I don't think the rhythm was there. And then the meat of the story is, of course, his affair with Donna Rice. And then it takes forever to get there. And then once it gets there, I thought it didn't. It wanted to do the sort of, like, we show you what's happening or what happened, and you decide, you, as the audience, make up your minds, which I think was what they wanted to do. But to me, that just made it very muddled and as if it had no point of view, no teeth to whatever it is it was doing. Because in this day and age, if you want to do a movie where you sort of take a side a little bit against the press, you have to have more teeth to your argument. Like, you know, if you look around at the time we're living in right now where our civil liberties are like threatened and you want to tell me that we should give politicians some slack a little bit, you're saying that, right? You're making that argument, but you're also making the argument against it. Then you need to have more panache and teeth and just a better argument than this movie is doing. It's just was very derivative. If you put it in the context of this year, it's very derivative. The arguments that it's trying to make are very derivative.
Mm-hmm. when it comes to cut politicians some slack, and I see what you're saying, but the argument is also that personal lives, there's no reason they should be the same as show business. So it does have this sort of mournful quality that I liked about how far we've fallen. I wish it had been more direct about invasion into people's sex lives and marriages as opposed to just invasions of privacy. Because obviously politicians who try to hide, I mean, we have a ton of them right now who are corrupt, and it would be good if somebody would air out their dirty laundry and see what's really going on. But when it comes to their sexual lives, that always feels very, that's really none of our business. And it seems like so many people lose their careers over the fact that they have non-traditional marriages, or, you know, they're sleeping around or whatever. And, you know, but are they good at their jobs? Are they, you know, that just seems to be not important. So I think the movie is mourning that.
Yeah, but it didn't make a good argument to me. I wasn't convinced. I thought it just didn't. It didn't do a good showing of, like, this is what we're saying. It's like, I want to lead that way, but I also want you to make your own mind. And for this kind of movie, it should have taken a stronger stand in the characters, in the build of the characters, in the dialogue between the different opposing views, like, all the journalists who were sort of pro and con. We just got one scene of that woman. I think it was the Washington Post, right? The woman journalist at the Washington Post who sort of provided the...
Ari Grainer's character.
Yes, the con sort of argument. And I just felt like it wasn't as strong. If that's the stand you want to take, you should have been stronger.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I do think the message is a little muddled, but I liked that it was trying to do this overview of what became of politics. And I didn't know, even though I lived through this story, I didn't know some of the things about the history of the way the press used to deal with politicians who slept around and things like that. So there's some interesting beats in it about, you know, the times when the press was a little more polite.
Yeah.
About people's personal lives.
Yeah. It did want to take a sort of sympathetic look at Donna Rice.
Yeah.
Right? So it tried to do that. But also it just sort of, like, left her hanging in the end. Like, I felt like that's what the movie tried to do. We need to, like, present Donna Rice as a human being. But then they start, and then it just, like, blah. What happened to her? What did she think of all this? Mm-hmm. We don't know. Like, that character is not allowed to tell us what she thought of what was happening then.
I actually think it did give her a fair shake, and that we got a lot of that. I mean, I agree. The movie is muddled and diffuse, but I thought it was compelling. That's what I'm saying. I was not bored at all, which people kept saying that they were while watching this movie. Look, I'm not saying it's a masterpiece, but I'm saying if you're interested in politics and the way things shifted in over time about the way press deals with politicians, I think it's worth seeing.
Did you like Hugh Jackman?
I did. It's not very much a showcase because it's very low-key performance. And he has a little bit of the task that Ryan Gosling has in First Man as well, which is very, you know, difficult. We always talk about Oscars, excuse me. Like, I care more about other things besides Oscars. But in the context of Oscars, that kind of role is very thankless, where the person's super, super guarded. So the actor's job is to sort of give you a peek at how someone who's very closed off feels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But those roles are inherently unshowy. I always feel like they don't really get that fair of a shake because they aren't trying to do the same things that other more, more extroverted performances are trying to do.
If that makes sense. Yes. The character is sort of a scold for a lot of the plot of the movie.
Yes.
He's like put into that position of like, he's always scolding. He's scolding the press. He's scolding his campaign, the people who work for him. He's scolding his child, his wife. So it's a very sort of unlikable character to be put like, oh, he's playing Gary Hart as the scold. So like, I don't know how you react to that. I think he was fine, but I also was just like, is that all you're going to do? You're just going to scold everyone around you?
His voice work was really good, though.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what Gary Hart sounds like, but I'll take your word for it.
Good. Because I have principles, and I don't just say things. I mean them.
Did you like Vera Farmiga?
I did. But again, I see why people aren't responding to this, because it's doing this very naturalistic thing, not just in the roaming camera and overlapping dialogue, but even within the performances, like, nobody's overdoing anything.
Yes.
And they're not trying to make their own performance, like, the center of it. Even Hugh Jackman.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's funny, while I was sitting there watching it, I was thinking back to what people had said about the movie, and this was what happens when you see a movie late. I realize it just came out, but, you know, people have been seeing it for a month. When you see a movie late, you're always thinking about what other people said of it, even if you don't want to. And I kept recalling that people acted like it takes forever within the front runner for Hugh Jackman to show up. But it really doesn't. So I think that's a funny... He's, you know, like the first 5 minutes, maybe, he's not in. But I had kept hearing, oh, like Hugh Jackman's barely in it.
Oh, who said that?
That was the first rush of people. I think they were expecting something much different. I think people were expecting more of like a biopic of Gary Hart. And this is more sort of a fly on the wall procedural of how the shit hit the fan.
So I'll tell you, so I saw it at an award screening. And you know how I said in last week in the podcast that all the award screening for A Star Is Born were booked up. This was completely not booked up. So I arrive, and I had booked for me and a guest, but you know, my guest couldn't come. So then the nice young woman who's letting people in, she's like, your guest is not here? She was so very disappointed. And then I go in, and it was literally 4 people, including me. So I'm just saying, nobody wants to see this movie, even for free, at an award screening.
Well, I will say, because of this, again, this is all about expectations and what you hear. The theater was packed last night.
Maybe good.
Maybe it's that neighborhood. For those who don't live in New York, Lincoln Square is a very sort of older neighborhood, moneyed neighborhood. So there were a lot of old people. And it was really crowded. I was surprised.
Maybe. Well, that's good. I mean, it's its first. I mean, they opened it on Election Day, but this is the first weekend.
Yeah. So anyway, oh, and as I said on Twitter, but for those who don't follow, when I was leaving the theater, I love to listen to people talk about movies as I'm leaving theaters. There was this old man who I had to slow down for because he was very wobbly, and I don't know if it was his wife or a friend or something, a woman was helping him. And he immediately starts talking about the Oscars. He's like, I think Hugh Jackman's going to get nominated for this. So I look at the woman, and she's like very, she kind of gives him the side eye. I was right behind them. And then she's like, I don't think so, but it was good though. Like, she clearly was going to say, do you follow the Oscars at all?
It's funny. I remember that people always talk about the Oscars. I remember when I saw The Theory of Everything, and I was leaving the theater, and also 2 people in front of me, a couple, and the woman, this time it was the woman who was saying, I did not see Eddie Redmayne there. I just saw, I can't even remember his name now. What was his character's name? but whatever that dude's name is, I'm so sorry. I forgot.
Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking. I just saw Stephen Hawking. And I was like, oh, He's winning that Oscar.
Eddie Redmayne is ...
Anyway, I think it was Chris last week who made the comment about this movie that maybe coming out during this time when there are so many other better films will not do this movie, like, will not help this movie. Like, if it came out in February or March or something, it might have done better, and I sort of agree with that.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think he was making that argument about... Or at least I've heard that argument about First Man before, which I also agree with. I think if you have a movie that's good, but not sort of energizingly exciting dramatically, it's maybe a better idea to counter-program, because imagine things like this, if they came out in the spring or summer, that people would be, like, relieved that they had something with meat to see. Like, that audience who's underserved in other times of the year.
Or, you know, in late winter, early spring, when there is hardly anything in theaters.
Yes. But then you're cutting off your Oscar chances. Are you talking about, like, February?
Yeah, but this movie was never going to get nominated for Oscars. Like,
well, we'll discuss that in a second with our screenplay discussion coming soon.
Coming soon. Get ready for it.
Okay, so our next movie is... Well, I'm not Spanish. I don't know the pronunciation. El Angel?
I think it's... I mean, I'm not Spanish either, but I think it's El Angel.
It's from Argentina. And it is about a true story from the 70s about a teenage boy who ended up in a life of crime, murdering people, stealing, etc. Apparently a very famous story within Argentina. The press dubbed him Angel.
Yes.
Because he
had
so pretty.
The baby face.
Yeah. A baby face. So this is from Luis Ortega, and it's produced by Almodovar.
Yes. But what I loved about it is that even though it is about this guy's crimes, but it's also sort of a friendship story about this guy he meets at school, and there is obviously sort of attraction between them, and they sort of form a gang between them and a couple of other people, including the other guy's mom and dad. It's very funny in that way.
Yeah, it's actually a strange story in terms of, like, the characters are all very peculiar, shall we say. I mean, it's in some ways true crime stories have, like, distinct rhythms that you know what you're getting into, but
yes,
the style of the film is very distinct, as are the characterizations. So I thought this was really good, even though I'm not sure what the takeaway is from it in terms of, like, does it reach greatness? I personally don't think so, but it's very stylish, very exciting to watch. The performances are really good, and the characters are really interesting.
I mean, they all wanted to fuck each other all the fucking time. Like, there was so much sexual tension.
It is a very,
everybody,
very horny movie. The horniness extends into the audience, because the co-star is Chino Darín, who is the son of Ricardo Darín, the Argentinian movie star. And he is scorchingly fuckable, let's just say it.
Yeah, he's very, very hot. And the lead character, he has so much sexual tension. Like, every scene they're in together, it's just so full of sexual tension. But also, our lead guy, sort of, his friend's mom wants to fuck him, but then he tells her he wants to fuck her husband. And it's so funny, because I just felt like every scene is so full of sexual tension. And then when they are their gang, there's also sexual tension between that thief and the mom. And then also with Angel, it's just like, they should have just called it Sexual Tension the Movie.
Yeah, it's pretty thick. Like, and I could see why, you know, it has, even though it's not directed by Almodovar, not written by him, I can see why it's an Almodovar-produced movie.
I mean, it has the Almodovar colors. It's, the colors are so vibrant. There's a lot of red, but also blue.
Yeah. So overall, I think this is definitely worth seeing. It reminded me a little bit of Burnt Money. Did you ever see that?
No.
Which was also a very queer true crime story about two lovers who were on a crime spree.
Was it in Spanish too?
It was also in Spanish, yes. So anyway.
It does dip in a little bit. Like, the first hour, I say, was amazing, and I was sort of so into it. The performances are great, and the sexual tension and all of that. But then it sort of goes on a little bit. It does pick up again at the end, sort of for how the story of this dude ends. But there were times it was like, okay, how long has it been? Like, you know, where are we going with this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there's one sort of cataclysmic moment within the movie, no spoilers, where afterwards the movie, I'm like, well, what are you going to do now when you've robbed the movie of one of its chief sources of conflict and one of its strongest elements? Yeah. So there is a little bit of that for the last half hour or so of the movie, but the ending is very hypnotic.
Yeah, it's a great ending. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And for Almodovar fans, Cecilia Roth plays the mother of Angel, whose name is actually Carlos.
Carlitos,
yeah.
Everybody called him Carlitos.
Yeah.
And that actor, I'm trying to find his name, but
Lorenzo Ferro.
Yes, he's very good. Like, he's
sort of first film.
Oh, wow. I can't believe it. He's
19 or 20.
Yeah. And they keep calling him, you know, there's a couple of scenes where they say, you look like Marilyn Monroe. The movie takes place in 1971. And then he tries to do a little bit of, like, the walk or something. He's very good. I loved his performance.
Yeah, he is really good. But do you agree with me, like, the takeaway, it's kind of like, what was that afterwards?
Yeah, definitely, yes.
It's a little bit speculative. Which I think is where it's interesting, but also where I think maybe the takeaway is kind of confusing because, you know, because this is a true crime story, but it's about these things that aren't expressed, like sexual tension, for example. It's much, even though the movie is quite homoerotic, it's not actually that sexual.
No, it's not.
So there's been, you know, criticisms that, you know, well, you don't actually know these things about these people, you know.
Yeah, I mean, because maybe it's based on a true story and they wanted to keep it vague because maybe, I mean, I don't know the backstory, but maybe those things weren't explicit in those people's lives, and so they didn't want to actually say stuff happened.
Yeah. Yeah, but also, I think people do this all the time. When anything is painted as queer, there's a contingency of people who complain, well, that's not what happened, because, you know, they don't want anything to be queered up. It's the whole thing. It's the same impulse that leads people to de-queer, like Bohemian Rhapsody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Queen.
Yeah. Yes. But in this time, I saw the fact that they wanted to fuck each other was not subtext. They actually don't do it, but it's there. Like, the desire is palpable. Like, you feel it. So for me, I thought, from that perspective, it was queer.
Yeah, no, I would definitely call this a queer movie. And it has some really, really indelible images, like, there's a moment where Carlitos covers Ramon, his would-be lover, the one he wants to be his lover, in jewels. That is, like, really a cool scene. Do you remember that moment?
Yes, very cool, yes. That is when he says, you look like Marilyn. Yeah, it's so cool. And so, can we just put Chino Darin in every movie from now on? He's so fucking hot.
Please.
And so, he's such a good actor.
In every... Yeah, in every movie that requires sexual tension, let's have him, please.
Or just in any movie, he can bring the sexual tension to whatever story it is.
That's true. We can put him in a Marvel movie and give those movies some actual sexuality. I'm kidding. We don't need everybody to be in Marvel movies.
Yes. I don't want to see any Marvel movies, so please don't put him in a Marvel movie. That will make me have to see a Marvel movie.
No, he is really, he's also, I mean, Lorenzo Ferro was great as Carlitos, but Chino Darren's like, he's kind of a movie star. It's kind of obvious watching this.
Yes, big, huge, hopefully. We'll see him in so many movies in the next few years.
And his dad's a movie star, so, you know, passing the genes down. Although his dad doesn't read as like the sexual being at all in the same way.
Yeah, I don't think he gets it from his dad.
But, I mean, I think the screen charisma is definitely passed down. Because Ricardo Darín's obviously very famous. He's in, like, every other Argentinian movie.
Yes, we've seen him in Wild Tales. He is in the new Asghar Farhadi. He's, like, he's in a lot of movies.
Basically, the Argentinian Oscar submission each year, if he's not in it, it's kind of a shock. But this one is his son is in instead of him.
He's like, I'm taking a year off. Let's send my son.
So, do you think this has a chance to get nominated?
It just might be too queer. But also, I think this year has just so many stronger other movies, and also like very famous directors who people like from all over the world who people might want to honor. I think this one, I'm not sure. Is it his second movie? He's a younger director, so he doesn't have the marquee name like people like Corrieta or Cuarón.
So Luis Ortega, this will definitely up his profile. He's only 38 years old, which is fairly young for directors.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. We'll see what he does next.
Okay. Oh, we also, a little sidebar. This week we also went to a play.
We did. We saw My Fair Lady.
Yes. Which, for those of you who don't follow Broadway, Lauren Ambrose, she was Tony nominated for Eliza Doolittle, but she has left the production. So now, Laura Benanti stars. So I was very excited because I love Laura Benanti, and the show starts, and, you know, the very first character you see is Eliza, you know, selling her flowers. And I'm like, that's not Laura Benanti. And it turned out we hadn't looked at our programs. We went on a Tuesday night, and it turns out on Tuesday night, another woman performs it.
But yes. But we were both, I was disappointed too, but she was so good. Her name is Kirsten Anderson that, you know, 10 minutes later, we were like just enveloped in the show and we enjoyed her in the whole thing.
And for those of you who are not New York natives, certain theaters in Manhattan have very specific reputations, and this played at Lincoln Center. I forget what the actual name of the theater is.
Vivian Beaumont.
Oh, the Vivian Beaumont. If anything plays at the Vivian Beaumont, you basically know it's going to be good. And their productions are very luxe. They do lots of like revivals of major classics, and they're always gorgeous to look at. And this was no exception.
Yeah, I think I saw The King and I in South Pacific there before.
Yeah. Yeah, they love Kelly O'Hara there. I'm really surprised she wasn't in My Fair Lady. Because usually if they do a revival at Vivian Beaumont, Kelly O'Hara is the lead, it seems like.
And The Light in the Piazza, she was in that too, right?
Yes.
That was years ago, maybe more than a decade ago, but that was the first time I ever saw a play there, a musical.
Yeah. So anyway, true to form, it's a very gorgeous production. It didn't win Tonys, really, or not very many of them.
It might have won something, I'm not sure.
It was very good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. You know, we all know the music, and just the songs take you through, like, so many amazing songs in this production. And the lead guy who plays Professor Higgins, Harry Haddon Patton, is really good. And he's sort of like, that part is always a little problematic, but I think he has, he did good with it.
Yeah, I felt Professor Henry Higgins was like reinvented for me. It was, I mean, not that I've seen that many productions of My Fair Lady, but I've seen a couple before this and the movie, and I've never, ever enjoyed Professor Henry Higgins, and I loved him. I thought he was giving it enough subtext and nuance that you felt like the whole of this person, and you, it's kind of like the depiction versus endorsement problem that old sexist material has. Mm-hmm. I felt like he really understood this character as a full human being. And so even though the character is very sexist, I didn't feel like the performance was sexist, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. He gave it a lot of heart, yeah.
Yeah. And so I also saw the wounded qualities, you saw the insecure qualities that he hides really well. I loved his performance.
Yeah. So also good was Jordan Donica, who played Freddie. And I think you said he sings your favorite song from the show.
My second favorite, On the Street Where You Live, yes.
Oh, such a good, you know, it ends the first half so good.
Yeah. And it had a lot of humor. Like, it was a very good production. And it's a little easier to get tickets now because it's been running, you know, for a while. You usually have to wait a little bit with the new ones.
Yeah. We enjoyed it. It was such a good night out.
Yes. And the Danny Burstein is replacing Norbert Leo Butz, who plays Alfred Doolittle, the father, the drunk father who has to get to the church on time, for those of you who know My Fair Lady. And Danny Burstein will be replacing Norbert Leo Butz in March, I believe. But they're both, like, great, great actors, so.
Mm-hmm.
And Rosemary Harris, Oscar nominee and Tony winner, is now playing Mrs. Higgins.
Mrs. Higgins, yeah. Which was played by Diana Rigg, who shaded Lauren Ambrose for taking a day off. Remember that?
No, I don't. Tell. So do tell.
It was a story that Lauren Ambrose, you know, was doing 8 shows a week, and then, I don't know, 2 months into whatever time, into the run, decided to take Sundays off.
Okay.
And then Diana Rigg, I don't know the exact quote, but apparently she said something, in my day, we just played the whole 8 shows. I don't understand this with people taking time off.
It does seem to be a more common occurrence now, because Laura Benanti's she's getting a day off, too.
Yeah, so they both are doing only 7 shows as opposed to the usual 8.
Which, you know, is what Bette Midler did for Hello, Dolly! As well.
Yes.
So I'm afraid it's going to become a trend.
It is. Like, now, if you don't take a day off, you're not a big enough star.
I do think, you know, there have been actors who've been very public about 8 shows a week is actually not good for your health when it comes to musicals. Your vocal cords and all that, which I totally understand the argument, but I do think maybe schedule shows for 7 performances instead of 8.
Yeah, right. You could do that, yes.
And give everyone, I realize it's a money thing, but still, then you end up with the problem of double casting and all these things, and people coming to the shows and being like, wait, I thought it was going to be this person, but it's this person, which is what happened to us. Yes. Although Kirsten, what's her name again?
Anderson.
Yes, we want to give her props. She was very good as Eliza.
Yeah,
and her voice is beautiful.
Yeah, she sang those songs so well. And I just looked it up. The show won the Tony for Best Costumes. That was the only Tony it won.
Yeah, basically, if you do My Fair Lady, you win Best Costumes. It's the Ascot Gavotte situation.
Yes, I guess it is.
A little Broadway curveball for your film experience podcast. So we can't end the podcast without discussing Oscars. So today we thought we'd discuss the screenplay categories.
Which are very exciting. You know, I was like looking at what's in play before we recorded, and I'm like, oh, these are some exciting movies and exciting you know, directors, writers who could or might get nominated.
Yeah. Let's start with adapted screenplay. Adapted, one thing, the reason I wanted to discuss this is I keep hearing people, you know, feeling that A Star Is Born is automatically in there, which I disagree with, kind of. I mean, it's definitely in the running, but, and I realize the other Star Is Borns have had writing success at the Oscars, but it's also the fourth version. And, you know, there are a lot of movies that are more writerly, shall we say, in the running.
Yeah. I could see it missing, but I could also see it getting included if people love it. But, you know, you're sort of thinking of it as sort of a Titanic thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and just that, you know, something a little more off the beaten path sometimes happens for screenplays. Something like that becomes a critical darling or has a good campaign or those things.
And also because Bradley Cooper is one of the credited writers and he will just have, you know, there are other categories where he can be rewarded.
Yes. So I do think it's an interesting category because I don't think there's that many sure things. I think if Beale Street Could Talk, based on the reviews and the prestige of the source material, as well as Black Klansmen feel like givens to me, and probably Can You Ever Forgive Me because it's about writers and it's really well written. Those three feel kind of secure for me, but beyond that, I think it's kind of a free-for-all. I think Widows could easily make it, but as we've seen with Gillian Flynn before, even if she has a massive hit, they might look the other way. Because she was not nominated for Gone Girl, which is insane. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, to me, Beale Street is the one here. I know Barry Jenkins won this category 2 years ago, but to take that novel, which is a novel of ideas, and crystallize it into a movie of ideas and keeping the framework of the love story, I think it's such a feat. It's a feat of directing, but I also think it's a feat of writing. So I agree that that Beale Street will definitely be included. I'd put it on top. With Black Klansman, I don't think it's a feat of directing it's a feat of writing because if there is anything you take about the movie, it's sort of how direct it is. And it, you know, its punches are so straight that sometimes, but it's definitely, I think the directing is more strong there. But I also think, you know, Spike Lee will definitely get nominated, despite there might be a little bit of controversy, right?
Because we played fast and loose with the actual story.
Yes. So, and that's from the writing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's in the writing, so that might take away a little bit of his chances. But, and he has other writer, I think it was a script that was written by two other writers, and then he rewrote it.
Mm.
It has
four screenwriters. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, but I still think it will make it if people like that movie, and definitely Nicole Hall of Center might finally get nominated for Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is crazy that she hasn't been nominated.
I know, because she's such a wonderful writer.
Yeah.
Beyond those three, though, I really think it's kind of a free-for-all. I mean, Widows, it seems strong to me, but you never know.
What about The Death of Stalin? Because Armando Iannucci has been nominated in this category before. He is somebody who the writers obviously revere. And I know this movie is from earlier in the year, but it's also that movie that sort of, it's more of a writerly movie because of all the punchlines and it's funny and it's like snappy dialogue, which is things that people look for in this category. So that might be an option there.
Yeah. I used to have First Man as like the front runner here, but I do think that would be an easy drop if people aren't enthused about the movie.
Yeah.
But I think it could still happen. I wish Wildlife had a really clear shot at this, but people just, that's another movie that's having the problem of enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, but don't you think, we like, love it.
Yeah, we love it, but also there is a sort of like a wife and husband team, and their narrative in all interviews has been like, he started writing it and then he gave me to give him notes. And there's this whole story that they sort of keep telling, that people are sort of, I think, in love with it a little bit, even though the movie has a very low profile. I think just the narrative might help them get in there. But also, going back to Widows, if people really pay attention to Widows and stop just calling it a heist movie,
right,
and notice that all the things that the script builds, the interrelationships between the main characters, but also building each character separately and giving them dimension, and not just dimension in the character, but sort of social dimension and dimension of living in Chicago and what the city means to each of these characters. This is all in the script. So
it's a very complicated script. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're a writer, you should be paying attention to all those things that are, that Widows is rich with. And that should make it a big contender.
Yeah. And if this were the 1980s, which it is not, I realize, if this were the 1980s, Crazy Rich Asians would get nominated here. I don't think it's outside. I don't think it's impossible. Because
I mean, it's very popular, right?
It's very popular. It's a huge hit. It would be a really easy way to honor it. And if it were the 80s, it would be nominated because they love to throw in big box office hits there for screenplay categories. Back in the 80s, like populist entertainment. But I don't know. The Oscars have kind of moved away from that. You know, I'm always arguing that they haven't, but within writing, like, things like that, it's more prestige-based and, you know, all that.
Yeah. I mean, if there is any justice, Burning would be a contender here, but...
But don't you think that's more of a directing feat, since we're separating them?
Yeah, I mean, it is, but it's based on a short story. I think if you're looking at adaptations that sort of become their own thing, which I think is sometimes something that is valued in this category, then Burning should be a contender, because the short story it's based on is different,
yeah,
but its own thing.
And there's a lot of other possibilities, so it'll be interesting, especially with the precursors, to see what happens, just because I feel like there's a lot of movies on the same tier in terms of long shot, or maybe I'm underestimating them, but Boy Erased, Black Panther, Disobedience would be an amazing nominee here. Incredible.
Your Nemesis.
Too.
Your Nemesis, Beautiful Boy.
Yeah, that too. And maybe Mary Poppins Returns will surprise us, and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It does seem like this category is not settled, is what I'm saying.
Yes. But if this really becomes, like, because Barry Jenkins has already won it.
Yeah.
If it becomes Spike Lee versus Nicole Hull of Center, that would be great.
It would, because either way we win, right?
Yeah.
And it would be cool to see someone win an Oscar right after winning an honorary in Spike Lee's
case. That would be very cool. And this is where they maybe can honor Spike Lee, because I hope he gets nominated for director, but it would be maybe tougher for him to win that with Cuarón in the mix.
Yeah. Do you think Black Panther has more of a shot here than I'm giving it?
I mean, do you have it in your 10?
Yeah.
Because if
I have it at number 10 right now. I do think, well, I really think Black Panther is no question happening in Best Picture for a nomination. I don't understand why people are doubtful about that. But I'm not, and I think technical categories, it will get a lot of nominations, but screenplay is a category I'm not as certain it's going to have a way in.
I mean, Logan got in last year, but that was a completely different feel that wasn't as strong as this year.
Yeah.
But I could definitely see it in the mix. Like, I think what we agreed on is that Black Klansman, Beale Street, and Can You Ever Forgive Me are the top three, and then after that, it's a sort of free-for-all for a few contenders, and it's definitely within those contenders.
Yeah.
So it's vying with Widows and First Man and all this.
And The Star Is Born. Yeah. And, you know, who knows, maybe Incredibles 2 will be stronger than I'm thinking. Because the original was nominated for screenplay, wasn't it?
I think so. I'm not sure. Yeah, and usually there is a Pixar or Disney movie in there. So that is another one that, yeah, could get in.
Yeah, so basically there's lots of possibilities. Pretty soon they'll narrow down and there will only be six, but it's exciting when it's open.
Yeah.
Original screenplay, I think, is clearer. Because I think Roma, The Favorite, and Green Book have absolutely nothing to worry about. Do you agree?
I mean, I haven't seen it, but... And I know if for Green Book, I just don't see it as top three. I mean, I haven't seen it yet. It opens next week, so I'll have a better opinion. But The Help didn't get nominated. And it sort of had the horde... Some of the same controversies that are going around Green Book with The Help and the way that it's presenting its story and all of that. So I think I could see Green Book missing. And, you know, I could see Paul Schrader being stronger because for First Reformed because he's such a giant of the industry and he finally made a movie that people love.
Yeah.
And if they really sort of talk about how he's never been nominated before.
Yeah, which is crazy.
Yeah, and A24, I don't think, has a stronger movie than First Reformed. I mean, in this category, they also have Eighth Grade, but overall, First Reformed, they have a couple of, at least a couple of chances for that movie to get nominated, so I could see this is where they put their chips, and Paul Schrader becomes stronger, mm-hmm. along with Roma and The Favorite.
I mean, A24 is an interesting case this year, because they've made themselves into an Oscar presence for sure, and they always release quality movies. But this year, their top contenders were all released early, and they don't have a last quarter release. They're not releasing anything for the holidays. So basically, their three big hopes this year are Eighth Grade, First Reformed, and Hereditary.
Yeah.
All of which seem like long shots in various categories, except First Reformed, which I think is in for actor.
Yeah, and if it goes in for actor, maybe it goes in also for screenplay, because I think, like, Ethan Hawke and Paul Schrader are going to help each other, right?
Yeah. But don't you think Eighth Grade is also totally possible in screenplay?
I can see Eighth Grade. Yeah, absolutely. Like, this is the movie, Eighth Grade is sort of the movie that, you know, if we can call it, the young hipper academy might get behind. It's like sort of the Lady Bird of this year. It's the movie that's about growing up, that's written about somebody who's younger, who's a writer-director. So it has some of the same narrative.
Yeah. I do wonder if... I don't know what kind of campaign it's getting, or if it's getting a campaign, but I do sometimes wonder about Sorry to Bother You here as well.
Yeah.
Because the people who love that movie really, really love it.
Yeah, I love it, and I hope it gets in. It's an audacious screenplay, So, and you know, this year, you know, there is no Her or Get Out or Eternal Sunshine. You know, those screenplays that sort of win in this category, which are about how audacious the concept is.
Yeah,
and I think maybe that spot is Sorry to Bother You, so that would help it.
I mean, theoretically, that could also be the spot that First Reformed is filling, though.
Yeah. But First Reformed is more classical, right?
Like, yeah.
Its concept is not as, like, whoa, gotcha, like Sorry to Bother You.
And I do think we have to look at former nominees here a little bit, at least. I think Eternity's Gate, which has an Oscar favorite writing it, Jean-Claude Carrier, and Isle of Dogs. So we have previously nominated screenwriters there, and Tully, which obviously probably not going to happen, but I'm going to keep mentioning it because it's brilliant. Diablo Cody.
Yes. Yeah, those are all contenders. And I got the screenplay for Isle of Dogs, and if they're sending it to me, you know, they send it to everybody in the Academy. So who do you think, is the front runner here? Because I think, you know, we have Roma, which is a movie that's going to be in many categories. And also The Favorite is it's not an audacious setup, but I think it's got that snappy dialogue, the cutting lines, and it sort of runs fast. These are things that, you know, we talked about how they're appreciated here. So do you see those two as the two front runners?
With the possible, we haven't seen Vice yet, which obviously could be considered a, you know, Adam McKay's been nominated before, you know, for writing. I could definitely see Vice showing up and making a fuss here if people like the movie. But right now, I do think it's between Favorite and Roma to win. Mm-hmm. I think Favorite is more of a screenplay achievement than Roma. I don't, even though I love Roma, but I don't really understand the hoopla about its screenplay. Because I think almost everything that's great about Roma is visual.
Yes, and Roma is going to win. It's going to be a stronger contender in those categories: direction, cinematography, production design, sound.
Yeah.
So yeah, and this is where the Favorite might shine. And if the Favorite becomes one of the top three or four movies, this might be the category that it wins. If it's not going to win actress, for example.
Yeah. But on the other hand, people. Often we've discovered people don't really think through their ballots. They just vote for their favorite movies, which in this case could be Roma. I'm not saying it's poorly written at all. I just don't. It's just very lightly written, shall we say. It's very sort of observational.
Yeah, it's not the first thing you. Yeah, it's not the first thing you think about when you think about Roma. It's not the screenplay.
Yeah.
What do you think about A Quiet Place? Which is having a, they are doing a campaign, and this is where one category where it could maybe get in.
I would hope not. I like A Quiet Place. Don't get me wrong. I just don't. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even like it, but it's one of the movies that are definitely trying to make noise.
I would be thrilled with, like, a nomination for Shoplifters, which is probably a very, very extreme long shot, but that would thrill me.
Yes. It would thrill me, too. I think it's a great screenplay.
I do think if what they had performed better at the box office, but it seems to be, you know, nobody has seen it, I think that would have been a threat here.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first-time writer-director, female, and it's a lovely movie, but nobody's seeing it, so chances are probably nil there.
Yeah.
So anyway, the point is, the screenplay categories are really exciting at this moment.
Yes. We could even get Vox Lux in. I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, online is sometimes... The internet is sometimes a very strange place, and one of the ways it's very strange is thinking that Vox Lux has Oscar chances. It does. I have seen it. It does not.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it, but I don't know. I was just making a joke.
But people keep talking about it for Oscars. I'm like, no, it's not that kind of movie. It's just not.
I mean, people keep talking about it, which means its campaign is working well for them. You know, they are making noise.
But, like, yeah. It's just... It's... No.
Is Hereditary also in original?
I believe so, but, yeah, that would be an extreme long shot, I would think, given the genre.
Yeah. I'm just, like, looking at what could be an original. Maybe Clint Eastwood is the Mule original.
Oh, I don't...
And also the Coen brothers. I think The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is original. I'm not sure, but I think it is. And they are, you know, people who...
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. And the writer's branch loves them.
Yeah, they've been nominated many times in this category. But that movie is also if we just talked about Vox Lux, and you do hear about that movie much more than you hear about Buster Scruggs. It's very quiet. I think Netflix is just Roma all the way and nothing else.
Which honestly is smart of them, you know. That's actually like understanding what you have. Although, there was a thing on Twitter last night that I'm very upset about. A tweet from Beck, the musician, talking about recording the score for Roma. Roma does not have a score.
Is this, are they remixing them? I mean, the movie has been playing since September.
Right, that's what I'm saying. But he tweeted out that he showed like a page of music and tweeted out that he was recording orchestrations for Roma. And I'm like, this does not make any sense whatsoever. One of the strengths of Roma is that it has no score and that you don't even realize it has no score because the sound is so immersive.
Yes, like it's the sound is one of its strongest elements. I don't think they're going to fuck it up like so late in its process.
So why is a famous musician tweeting that he's recording a score for it? I mean, what the holy fuck?
Maybe he's just confused.
He got the name wrong of the movie. I mean, he quoted their Twitter handle and everything. I don't know.
I mean, I saw the tweet, but I don't know. Like, the movie is closed. It's played so many festivals. So I don't understand it.
All I know is that when I saw the tweet, I was instantly having nightmares about The New World, Terrence Malick's The New World, and how I never understood what version I even saw because they kept changing it after it played for critics. I was like, you don't do that. Like, people review one thing, that's what you release.
Yeah, but also this movie, like, played so many festivals. It won the at Venice. Like, I don't think they will change it. I mean, who knows? But, let's just hope Beck is confused.
Let's hope. Maybe it was all an elaborate hoax. Or maybe Netflix is doing something really strange, like on streaming it's gonna have a score. Like I have no idea. I was really thrown by that.
Yeah. That I can understand.
And I could see it ruining the movie, having a score.
Yeah. The sound is definitely like
it's one of the best parts of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's what gets you in, and it's an experience. Like, what I love about Roma is that the feelings that I felt watching it in some of those immersive scenes, which were completely reliant on the sound, and it was like nothing I have ever experienced at the movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't understand why you would change that, but.
Especially when so many reviews have noted that. It's not even like people have been like, it would be better if it had a score. It's not even like a criticism of the movie. It's what people love about the movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's our podcast.
Yes. Well, thank you guys for listening, and let us know what you think we will be nominated in the screenplay categories. And if you've seen The Front Runner, we want to hear what you thought.
Or El Angel.
All El Angel, yes. Both movies.